From theunts.com, this is the Unts Podcast. Featuring artist interviews, unreleased tracks, and previews of the biggest events in electronic music. Available every week at theunts.com. Hello and welcome to the Unts Podcast. I'm your host, Anand Harsh. My guest this week is Darren McFadyen, better known as Freak Nasty. Since the 90s, Freak Nasty has been at the cutting edge of hard-hitting, cabinet-rattling, in-your-face bass music, from his early days in the drum and bass scene in London to his down-and-dirty drum step of today. Not only is Freak Nasty a vanguard in the industry, but he's also an agent of social change with his website giveback.net, which has raised money and improved living conditions for many underprivileged people around the world. His latest single, Dread of the Controls, is out today on Moody Music. Let's get to the interview. So you were born in Fiji and raised in New Zealand. You must have been exposed to a multitude of different musical styles and flavors as a kid.
Yeah, and New Zealand and Australia, I think, are very interesting like that. And I think still to this day, there's this dynamic where you get the English stuff before the Americans and the American stuff before the English. And I think the internet's changed that a fair bit. But still, you get this amazing cross-pollination in the charts of the diversity of the English charts, which will be anything from classical, from opera, through to, you know, underground dance music, literally like dubstep in the charts, and through to rock music and so forth. And the American charts, which tend to be more commercial, and these days more of the R&B hip-hop end of things. So it always has been a very interesting spotlight that for me, and both of those different areas, the UK and Europe and America, fascinated me for different reasons.
I imagine. Now, did you ever play instruments, or did you jump right into beat making?
Yeah, I used to drum for years as a kid and play guitar. Play a bit of bass and keyboard, enough for me to be able to write whatever I want to write, but mainly drums and guitar, really.
When did you start producing electronic music?
When I was at school in New Zealand, in a band, the keyboard player bought a sampler in one day. And for me, you know, that was just a whole new world, seeing what you could do with a sampler. Because, you know, back in the day, you know, before, at the time of the original Akai samplers and the early Mirage samplers, there was nothing really out there that was consumer price that you could do what you could do to make a record like a Public Enemy record or, you know, Jungle Brothers record. So for the first time, this became available to kids, you know, for a hefty price tag still, but not like the $100,000 or $200,000 that a Fairlight would cost you.
Sure.
Back in the day. So, yeah, around that period in the late 80s and early 90s, you know, being a kid and seeing that technology just come through into the mass markets was incredible. So that, for me, I was playing at first in bands and then went through to discovering samplers and realizing what you could do with them was just, you know, so much wider scope for creativity for me.
And were you emulating some of the hip-hop you were hearing from the United States and likewise from England, whoever was using sort of electronic beats and samples?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I loved all the hip-hop stuff at the time. And at the same time, it was incredible to see bands like LFO from the underground of the UK doing these crazy raves out in the fields and illegal raves and then going into the charts next week and playing Top of the Pops, you know. So it's a fascinating culture in that respect. You know, both of them, I think, were incredible. And I guess what tipped the difference for me was that, not being a vocalist, a lot of the dance music was instrumental. And I felt like it was easier for me to complete the project myself by heading toward the UK. So at that time, I was in New Zealand, moved to Australia for a little bit, and then had to decide between New York and London. And I ended up in London. I went by in New York, actually, and hung out for a bit, and it was cool, and went straight through to London, and was there for a long time.
Now, how'd you get picked up by Botchett and Scarper? You were with them for a while.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just one of those things that when you start in London, there's a lot of people in a lot of different scenes just making music, and, you know, you get to know the guys who are making a similar kind of music, and either from studios or friends who work in studios, and there's a lot of people in London. It's very common for people to start up labels, and Botchett was another little label that was being started up at the time as an offshoot for Downtempo Music on the back of Sour Recordings, who did the original Shy FX records and T-Power records, and I think some of Trace and Ed Rush's early records and stuff. So they were one of the more successful. I think they had the first jungle hit in the charts in England with the original Nutter. And so, ended up hanging out with that crew and making records, and people into the vibe, and everyone was just sort of rolling with that same kind of feel, and it happened that way. It was just one of those synchronicities, really.
We transform sound into light, and the speed of light is 186,000 miles a second. So you divide the distance to Mars by the speed of light, and you get the length of time it takes our light waves to reach Mars.
Sometimes, like tonight, for instance, we get no answer.
Yo, me and my booming back at you, watch you back in the dome. We ruling minds like season ruling broke. 186 style, miles to the second.
Booming back at you from Freak Nasty's 1999 release, Freaks, Geeks, and Mutilations. You've been a seminal force in the breakbeat and drum and bass scenes for much longer than a decade. What's your take on how those styles have evolved over the years? You've sort of been there from the genesis and seen them grow and shape themselves throughout the years.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, every scene, and you see it with the, you know, with the, you saw it, the garage scene as well, and with the grime scene and the dubstep scene, they all go through a period where there isn't really a label for the genre at first, so there's an incredibly wide palette of creativity of people doing all sorts of different music that kind of gets lumped together under a particular genre tag at some point in time. And then once it gets a genre tag, more people start making it, and more the clubs become more popular, and you end up with more dance floor bangers, and then everyone starts making the sort of dance floor bangers. And you get a little less diversity, and then you get more uniformity come through sort of in the last phase, and then a lot of the innovators move on to something else or take it underground and come up with something new. And I think drum and bass has gone through that phase, that cycle of phases, I think two or three times, probably going underground and coming up with a new sound, and going underground when that's been rinsed out and coming up with another new sound that's different. And breakbeats had to do the same thing a couple of times. And I think that any scene that's been around for 10 years or longer has had to deal with that, well, enjoy that period of immense creativity in the beginning, and then go through that stagnation where it has to reinvent itself, where, you know, you end up being your genre is a dirty word for a while, and then a new form of that comes up that's kind of hip and everyone's into it, and it kind of reverses itself and becomes a flavor a month again. I think you see, you know, when you've been in the music business for a while, you see those cycles go around. It's really interesting, even within each genre, seeing how it's going to reinterpret itself and come up with something new. And just when you think they can't, they do, you know?
And I think we're seeing that now with dubstep. Certainly it's been in the UK for a while, and then it was exported to the States, and all these artists started playing with it and adding their own spin. And like you said, now it's gone through a huge period of being out in the open and popular in clubs. And so now it's probably, as part of that cycle, going to go back underground. I wonder, as part of your MO in being at the forefront of whatever the new musical frontier is, your take on dubstep sort of harkens back to the ostensible root of dubstep, which is dub music, which many of your contemporaries seem to have forgotten altogether.
Yeah, I mean, dub music is, you know, dub music is half of the DNA of dance music, really. You know, James Brown and Lee Scratch are the DNA of dance music. And so one way or another, it always makes it in there for me. And you know, I love dub music. You know, the bass obviously is a huge influence on dance music, of all forms of dance music. And, you know, for me, what I DJ now as well, I just call it bass music, man, because fortunately, and I think it's really awesome that it's gone this way, is that there's people are less concerned with genres now, which is great. The kind of iPod culture has taken over now, where kids just have whatever on their iPod. They're not fussed whether you drop a Black Sabbath track next to a Lee Scratch track, next to a Benga track, next to a whatever, you know.
Sure.
So, you know, and it's kind of nice. And that way, it just, for me, the bass is the connecting factor between all the tracks that I play. And then it's just up to me to sequence them in a way that makes sense.
Flasher, listen to them tune our audio. To all of the peacemaker them, man, watch out, okay, why I'm gonna think now I'm gonna remember.
Hey.
Freak Nasty versus Prophet Things, that's the Peacemaker dub right here on the UNS podcast. You're known for some high-profile remixes of KRS-One, Khalees, Michael Franti. Do you have a particular approach or formula when it comes to remixing an already popular track? Or maybe just when you're approaching remixes to begin with?
Everyone's different, really. And I guess, you know, something really well-known like Sound of the Police, you think about differently just because you know and love the original so much. For me, that was the case. But, you know, I pretty much do the same thing with each one, is just take out the parts of it that I like and that will inspire me to try and do a significant reinterpretation so it's worth putting out, rather than I'm not really one to do a remix that's particularly true to the original. Yeah, so it's more giving myself the room to reinterpret it rather than trying to get something that's going to trade off the notoriety of the original.
Sure. On a similar tip, you've co-produced tracks with heavy hitters like Bass Nectar, Major Lazer, Switch, Heavyweight Dub Champion. I wonder, what's your approach in the studio when it's not just you behind the controls? What role do you tend to find yourself in, or what do you prefer to what do you prefer as your role?
It's really different with every person, actually. With Heavyweight Dub Champions, we did it pretty much on the internet, you know, sending files backwards and forwards. And it ended up, we used the remix I did rather than the original, of which they were going to finish, and I'm sure that's in the pipe somewhere. For Bass Nectar, we did it over the internet, but we did a lot more backwards and forwardsing and on the phone as well and stuff. So it was kind of like just like in the studio, but it took a lot longer. And with Switch, we kind of, we were in the studio, and I think we were just chucking beats together as quickly as possible. I think we're doing 3 or 4 a day. You know, in or well, 2 or 3, I think, in a day. We did that for a couple of days and just chose the ones that we thought were the hottest. And, you know, in that case, it was one of us with a laptop between the speakers, the other one with a laptop and the headphones sitting at the back of the room, and then swapping every couple of hours. So it just depends.
And Bass Nectar with Viva Tibet from giveback.net. Let's talk about your social activism, which is an undeniably huge part of your music and who you are as an artist. Tell me about giveback.net. I know you've put out big releases with huge stars in support of Tibet, music programs for disadvantaged youth, and even irrigation initiatives in Africa.
So with giveback.net, what we're trying to do is to allow artists who are passionate about any particular cause to be able to support that cause with their music and with their you know, with their tours. So being that artists are genuinely passionate kind of people and inspired kind of people, we thought it'd be nice for them to have that kind of that avenue, but without having to create it themselves, because I know how busy it is just being an artist and a DJ and traveling and being in the studio all the time. So it really wasn't meant to be some big thing. We just thought it'd be a nice idea if artists had that avenue available to them. And initially it started out with thinking we could spread it a lot more easily, starting out as an online social network, but then we realized you had to have a lot of money to make that roll. So now we just keep it pretty boutique and just work release by release or tour by tour, and just work with people that have a similar vibe and are into what we do, and it's sweet. It works really nicely like that, and you know, we really enjoy doing it and are happy to bring on board anyone who wants to be involved in the project.
Do you have a particular pet project that you're working towards right now, either a program or some goal you'd like to reach?
Well, we just raised some money for the Musicians Making a Difference charity in Australia, which uses music programs to help disadvantaged kids and youth at risk in Australia. And so that was sweet doing that. And really, we just try and do it on an ad hoc basis. So if someone comes to us and says, hey, I want to do a project, we talk about what they want to do and who they'd like to support, and then just work off that basis to either work it around a piece of music or to work it around their tour. You know, the last couple that I've done, I've used the idea of VIP tickets at the gig. So kids who are really into the artist can buy a VIP ticket, which allow them to come backstage and, you know, hang out with the artist and get some signed posters and stuff like that. We'll pay a premium price for the ticket. And that all that money will go to supporting this this cause. And we've had people say to us, man, I was going to come anyway, so this is awesome. I get to do something good in the world for my money, as well as coming and seeing one of my favorite artists. So it's just, you know, works well for the artist to connect with their fans more, and it adds a deeper level of meaning to the party experience as well, which is cool.
That's fantastic. You've been with a number of record labels throughout your career. What do you feel Moody Music has to offer to the electronic music industry?
I think Moody are amazing, just because right now that whole West Coast sound is so hot, and they've been doing it right from the beginning and, you know, really just soldiered away, staunchly creating their own thing. And I think really the whole West Coast sound right now is the first new turn for electronic music that has come specifically out of America. You know, generally it comes out of England and then gets spread around the world, and then, you know, the US will develop their own take on it, like with dubstep, for example. It's sweet to see that happen. It's great to see. It's kind of like a bit of a coming of age in a way for bass music, to see a new genre come out of so strongly, come out of America. So I think Moody are on the forefront of that. Also, they do a lot of, you know, they're not afraid to do stuff that's pretty left field, even within that genre, and to be really experimental. I admire that with them, and they're just so good with all the digital stuff and getting their music out there. And I've known Dove for years, you know, the label head Dove, who's also an awesome DJ, and we just played out in Australia together, actually. You know, he knows the electronic scene inside out. He's been doing it for years, and he's worked with iFunk Distribution way back in the day when I first started coming to America to play in America. He was with them. So he's dealt with everything. He's just seen the change of the industry and adapted, and he's at the forefront of digital distribution and getting good music out there to people who care about it.
Reddit the Controls, the latest release from Freak Nasty, out today on Moody Music. So what can you tell me about your latest release, Dread at the Controls?
It's a bit of a departure for me. It's a 4-4 track, Dread at the Controls, which is not something I've done. I think I did one 4-4 track on my first album, but it's not something I've pursued too heavily, and I don't really know why it came out like that. But, you know, it did, and I'm really happy with it. And the B-side, or the double A-side, or the whatever you want to call it, the MPB side, is more like a drum step stroke dancehall kind of vibe. And again, I just tried to do a couple of things I hadn't really done before, just push the boat out a little bit and do something a bit interesting and maybe a bit surprising, since it's the first thing that I've properly had out for a while. Don't know, see what people think.
Well, we think it's fantastic. Finally, we're all very excited about your big Monsters of Bass tour with Marty Party and Opiu. What can you tell me? How are all three of your styles going to mix and mash for the fans out there that are going to be catching you throughout February and into March?
I think they're quite different, which is good. It's going to be really interesting because I tend to play pretty tearing up front stuff now. And Opiu has this kind of bouncy party glitch hop kind of vibe, which is awesome. And then Marty has this kind of deep, almost like psychedelic crunk kind of vibe. And it's three very different takes on the bass style, you know. And in a way, I guess, even though I play a bit of glitch and drum stuff and stuff like that, they're sort of more firmly rooted in the West Coast sound. So it's an interesting intersection, I think, between the UK version of that kind of hip-hop tempo sound and the Californian version of that sound. So it's kind of, there's a nice linear flow between us, but distinctly different takes on that sound. I think it's going to be fun. I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a monster tour.
Absolutely, like the name suggests.
Right.
Darren McFadgen, thank you so much for being on the UNS podcast.
Thank you very much for having me here, man.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's UNS podcast. Special thanks go to Dove with Moody Music and, of course, my guest, Darren McFadgen. His latest release, Dread at the Controls, is out today on Beatport and everywhere in a month. The huge Monsters of Bass tour with Marty Party and Opiu will be kicking off in February. Visit theUNS.com for dates. Coming up next week, French electro and synth pop group Tahiti 80 will be featured on the UNS podcast. These indie electronica darlings are releasing their Darlin' EP on Monday through their own label, Human Sounds, and their full-length album, The Past, The Present, and The Possible, will be out on February 22nd. Remember to visit theUNS.com for news, artist profiles, and tour dates from across the electronic music spectrum. There are also some great contests at theUNS.com. You could win tickets to see Vibe Squad and RD, Kilowatts and Blue Tech, Big Gigantic and Kratty, or an autographed CD from Grammy-nominated BT. And go ahead and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, write us a review, tell us what you think of the show. If you have any questions, comments, or complaints about the program, or you'd like to be a guest on the UNS podcast, contact me at anand@theUNS.com. That's A-N-A-N-D @theUNS.com. K Catch you next week.